How you doing? My name's Chad. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. Yeah, you're right. You just do kind of start from the beginning. a little bit nervous to be here tonight. Thanks for having me. I guess I'll just start, you know, from the beginning, like where it started, just a little bit of my background growing up. I grew up in Huntington, West Virginia, and I love being from West Virginia because somebody's always got something to say about being from West Virginia. So, I grew up, my parents, they got divorced when I was two, but it was fine. They couldn't get along. They tried to get along for the sake of me and my brothers, but couldn't do it. So, I mean, they tried for us, so I don't, you know, don't hold any harsh resentment toward them or anything like that. My mom, growing up, my mom was a youth minister, and my dad was a bartender. So, you know, I always say I got the best of this program at the beginning, booze and God, you know, the basis of it all. And growing up, of course, you know, I was always even before, yeah, as far back as I can remember, just being uncomfortable with my skin, scared of everybody, scared of everything. You know, I could never really socialize well with others. I remember getting dropped off in the parking lot or the little playground when I was even in preschool, and all the other kids were going, like, you know, talking to other kids, and I just stood in the middle and cried because it was just terrifying to me. Just the thought of, you know, going out and having a conversation with somebody. It was just a terrifying thought. So, growing up, I was a big mom's boy, loved my mom. And then towards right when I started getting into drinking and everything, I started leaning towards my dad's way of life, which was, my dad calls himself the oldest teenager in Huntington, and he really is. He just parties, and he's a good guy, but he just parties, and he runs bars. And the whole time I was growing up, he ran the number one bar in West Virginia. And so I grew up there. Doormen were my best friends, and I shot pool with them, and I learned how to make drinks, and, you know, and my dad always would teach me how to spot a fake ID and blah, 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 count money, you know. So I thought this was the life. This was the life right here. Money, fast times, you know, tell me about all the fights he gets in, stuff like that. And so that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted. And I remember the first drink I took, I think I was 14 or 15. And I remember that buzz came over me, and it was the answer that I was looking for. That's what I thought. That first buzz came over me, and I was like, this is it. Because I felt comfortable. I didn't have that scare of being scared of anything, really. That fear that I had lived with for such a long time went away. And I felt good. I could tell jokes. I felt funny. Probably wasn't funny, but I felt funny. And, you know, and I could do what I wanted. And that's from that first time, I said, you know, this is what I want out of life. And this is it. And 9th and 10th grade were just like, you know, I drank whenever I could get it. And then 11th grade went to, you know, drinking, getting in trouble with police. And then 12th grade just became to skipping school, drinking, being drunk at the job. And my job during my senior year of high school was driving brand new Chryslers around. I worked at a Chrysler dealership. And drinking at that job wasn't ever a great idea, but it didn't really matter. And, you know, I got fired from that job, and, you know, I started having the consequences come in at 12th grade, had, you know, getting arrested and all that stuff, and it was no big deal. The first, you know, I had made those little things to my mom, like, all right, I'm going to stop drinking after getting arrested, her picking me up. All right, I'm going to stop it, you know, I've got a problem, I'm going to stop. And then the first big thing that happened that really disrupted my life and shook me to my core was my first blackout. I'd never believed in blackouts. My friends would say, well, I don't remember that from the other night, and I thought they were lying. I thought they didn't want to remember what they did the other night. And I remember I had my first blackout, and I was living with my mom at the time, and I was at a party, and then I woke up in my bed at home, and it was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, you know, oh, God, for somebody who doesn't believe in blackouts, you know, you're like, how did this happen? And I knew it wasn't a good thing because I never went home because my mom was a youth minister, so when I was drinking, I never went home. And I knew it was a bad thing when I woke up in my bed at my mom's house. But, of course, you know, me being the good alcoholic I am, denial all the way through. So I said, no, this is okay. Everything's okay. It might be all right. And I get up, and I've got cuts and scrapes all down my body, and I can't walk on my feet. I got like the stone bruises on my feet, And, of course, once again, I'm going to deny it. It's all good. Everything might be all right. It still might be all right. And then I remember I looked at my shirt and it was covered in blood and mud. It's like, oh, God. It might be all right. And then my mom, she meets me at the top. She meets me at the top of the steps. And she said, you remember how you got home last night? And, of course, after denial doesn't work, I go into lying. Yeah, I remember how I got home last night. The girl that brought me home. And she's like, no, you need to sit down for this one. And that's when that kind of moment of clarity, you can't hide from the truth anymore, that's when that sets in and the fear comes in too. And she said, I got a call from the police at 4 o'clock in the morning. And she's like, I'm used to those calls, but this call was different. And she said, somebody had found you passed out in their yard with a baseball bat in your hands. I was like, oh, God, really? And she said, yeah. And she said, when I got down there, there was 2 cop cars, a fire truck, and an ambulance. And they were bringing you out of the ambulance, telling everybody to go F themselves. And they just handed you over and said, you know, you need to get this kid help. He was a couple, you know, an hour or so going into a coma. And so that's the first time where I was like, wow, I need to do something about this. So I told my mom, I said, okay, I'm not going to drink till I'm 21. You know, I'm not going to drink till I'm 21. And she had a friend that was in AA. And I said, "Why don't see if he can come over and he'll take me to a meeting." And she said, okay. Talked to the guy on the phone. He said, you want to go to a meeting? I said, yeah, I want to go to a meeting. And he said, okay. So he came over to pick me up. And he came to the door and knocked on the door. And I said, you know what? I don't think I'm going to go to a meeting with you. And you know what? He said, okay. Call me when you do. And he left. He didn't give me a hard time. I thought this was going to be a big, awkward thing. And he said, okay, call me when you do. I'll be here. And so I thought I would put myself on house arrest at my mom's house for like a month, you know, and then after a month, I remember it was miserable. I just sat in my mom's basement. And after that, I thought, okay, I'm going to go out. I'm going to go out with my friends. It's been a month. Everything will be good. I don't want to drink. And I'll just go out to a keg party because that's what sober people do. They go out to keg parties, you know? So I go out to a party and a guy offers me a drink and I said, no, I don't. I'm not going to drink. I'm stopping. I'm not going to drink anymore. He said, oh, come on, that's not the chat I know. And I said, okay, I'll drink. And that's as far as my defenses get me. I could say no once, but you ask me twice, I'm done. So you know, and then once again, my thinking is, well, this time it's going to be different, you know, because I know a little bit more about it, and I know where my limits are, and I just won't drink pure grain anymore, and everything will be fine. You know, and that set into another stint of, you know, drinking. And then my mom, for my graduation present that year, she said, you like the outdoors? I got an outdoor camp that you can go to up in Canada. And I was like, fantastic. And I went up there, and I found out it was a bad kids camp. And it was out in the middle of the Canadian wilderness. And I had to stay up there for a month, no smoking, no drinking, no nothing. And I was like, but it's Canada. I'm legal age up here. I can drink up here. And they said, no, you can't do it. So it was a very hard experience. That's the first time I remember we canoed 200 miles in a month. And, I remember I was just miserable the whole time because of course, you know, I was out of shape and all that. And I remember, third night up there, I was in the tent and I was shaking and I was sweating and I was sick to my stomach. I couldn't eat anything. I remember I got enough strength to climb out of this, crawl out of this tent that we were in. Everybody else was sound asleep. And I got to crawl out of this tent that I was in, and I went to this creek. It was beautiful. I mean, beautiful area. It was just creek flowing into a lake, and it was just wonderful. And I remember I got down on my knees right there, and I said, God, please. Because by this time, my relationship with God was, I grew up in the youth minister and everything like that, and my relationship with God was, the whole time in my life, I believed in God, but I just didn't understand, didn't know. I'd pray just because my mom told me to pray. But I remember once I got to drinking, I made a conscious decision that I was going to stop praying. And it wasn't anything like, oh, I hate God or anything like that. It was just God became inconvenient in my life. It made me feel bad for what I was doing, and I just decided to take it out of my life. And I just stopped praying, and it was just kind of like, God, you know, you do your thing, I'm going to do mine. And but I did do the foxhole prayers, you know, of course. And I did one that night. I crawled out to that creek and I said, God, please just send a plane or a boat or something, get me the hell out of here. I can't do this, please. I can't do this. And you know, and I didn't know then, but I've realized, you know, since then, is God didn't do that. He didn't do that. But he gave me the strength to get through it. And I did. I had the strength, and for something I didn't think I'd be able to do, you know, God came in and gave me the strength to do it. And he didn't send that plane. You know, I have to get through things sometimes. And came home, hadn't drank in a month, and I felt great. Felt great. And was the first thing I did was buy a bottle of liquor in the airport. And because that wasn't the problem, I didn't think. I think it was just, I just thought, oh, I didn't know enough about it. Or I didn't really know myself. I didn't have confidence in myself. So now I have some confidence in myself. So, you know, drinking will be fine. Well, that just led on to another spree and led on to a DUI. And, you know, and then my mom kicked me out of the house. And then I moved in with one of my buddies and his parents. And after a month, they found my clothes in their front yard, so I said, well, okay, I got to go on. But they were really nice about it, though, because they didn't make me pay rent, and they helped for food. And then when they threw my clothes out in the yard, it was kind of just a symbol. You know, your time is up here. And I picked up my clothes, and I put them in the bag, and they said, we'll give you a month to find a place, which was really nice. I didn't have to do that. And so my brother and my dad at the time were living down in Wilmington, North Carolina. So I was like, wow, I don't know anybody down there. Nobody knows me. This is a chance. This is a chance for a new start. A new me. I can be who I want to be down there. And so I remember I moved down there, and I had all the hopes in the world. And I remember I'd been down there for 2 weeks, and I was looking in the mirror, and it was just like, my God, how'd you find me? It was me looking back. And I thought I had left that me in West Virginia. So when I was living down there, the drinking just got worse. Got introduced to moonshine down there, which was not a good thing for me. I was blacking out every night, waking up with broken hands, you know, and none of my friends can tell me how I got it, and I was miserable. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I just hated myself. I mean, I truly hated myself. Couldn't stand to even be in my skin. Felt like a ghost in the world. I remember I was down at the beach, and everybody goes down there, you know, right in the summertime and vacations. And I remember being down there and seeing all these happy families running around and all these happy people because they're at the beach having a good time. It's summertime. And I was sitting there pale as can be because I just drank all night and slept all day until I had to go to work. And I just remember I just felt like a ghost in their world. Like, they were on a completely different plane than I was. And I could never make it to that plane that they were at. This was my life. And there's nothing I could do about it. And it was just very dark, dark time for me. And it just got terrible. And my brother asked me after about 2 years if I wanted to go up and see my mom for Mother's Day. And I said, no, I don't want to see her. And he said, well, why don't you come on up? And I said, no, I don't want to go back up to West Virginia to see mom. And then finally, I don't know why, but the last, like, 2 hours before he left, he said, come with me. I said, all right, I'll go. And I thought, like, I'll go up and party with all my old friends and eat my mom's food and everything will be fine. And I went up there, and that was the way it was for the first, you know, 2-3 days. Everything was fine. The awkwardness between my mom was there, but it wasn't bad, and I was drinking, partying with my old friends. And then one night I came home, and I woke her up accidentally just out of my drunkenness. And I don't remember much from that night, but I do remember this. My mom woke up. She hadn't seen how bad I'd gotten. She hadn't seen me in, you know, years. And she walked into the kitchen, and she said, Chad, you're drunk. I said, yeah, I am, I know. And she said, she just started crying, just wailing crying. And I went up to try to hug her, to settle her down, and she backed away. And she was shaking, and she was scared of me. And she balled up into a corner and was just rocking and crying. And, you know, that really shook me because, you know, this woman that, you know, like I said, I was a mama's boy when I was growing up. And this woman that I love so much. And, you know, she was supposed to be, you know, the woman that loves you, you know, the only woman that loves you in your life or whatever, you know, is supposed to, you know. And she was scared to death of me, and it shook me. And I said, well, you know, whatever. And I left her on the floor, and I said, I'll be out of your hair tomorrow. And, so I slept it off, and then I woke up to my brother standing over top of me. And my brother's about 2 inches taller than I am, about 100 pounds heavier than I am. And he said, how could you do that? I said, what? He said, how could you let mom see you like that? And I said, I didn't have a choice in the matter. I said, she woke up. She saw me the way I was. Sorry. And he said, I can't believe you. You disgust me. And I was like, get away from me. And I tried to walk away, and he kept on pushing me, and he's backed me up into a corner. He's like, you know what? You're just no good drunk. And he's like, you just disgust me. And so he backed me up into a corner, and once again, he's a lot bigger guy than me, and he installed that fear into me while I was little, too, so I never stepped up. But I started strangling him. I started strangling him, and he thought I was going to stop. And I had no plans on stopping. And I remember he fell to his knees, and I kicked him out the door, and I locked the door. And I remember I was sitting there, once again, in my mom's basement. And, you know, when I was growing up, after my mom and my dad split up, my mom and my brother and I, that's all there was in the house. And we were really, really poor, but we had a lot of love in the family. These were the two most important people to me in my life. And I realized right then that they were gone. And it wasn't like, I didn't lose them. I gave them up. I gave them up because alcohol was more important to me in my life than them. It took their place. And once again, I was like, well, whatever. It's fine. Everybody's got their cross to bear. This is mine. Whatever. And then my mom came home, and she said, I want to talk to you. And I said, I want to talk to you. And she chased me around the house and said, I want to talk to you. I said, I want to talk to you. And then finally, I remember I collapsed on the couch, and I just started crying. I hadn't cried in a long time. I just started crying. I cried really hard for a really long time. And I told my mom, I said, the only thing I've ever wanted to be in my life is a good man. And I said, I'm not. I'm terrible. And she said, why don't you quit drinking? Why don't you try to quit drinking? And I said, Mom, I've tried that many times before. And up until that point, it's like I'd never saw the correlation between any of those two things. And she said, why don't you try to quit drinking? I said, I can't do that. I said, I've tried so many times before, I can't do it. And she said, why don't you ask God? And every other time, like I said, when in jail, I'd done the foxhole prayers, God, get me sober. It wasn't God, help me get sober. It was God, get me sober. It was God, I want you to slap the drink out of my hand. I just don't want to drink anymore. And when she said that to me, I said, okay, I will. And I remember that night, I got down on my knees. I'd never got down on my knees before to pray. But for some reason, I got down on my knees that night to pray. And I said, God, the only thing I want to do, I don't want to drink anymore. And I said, I need help. And that was May 20th of 2003, and since that day, I haven't had another drink. And it wasn't by my doing. It wasn't my doing, because the next day, I had to go back down to Wilmington, North Carolina, because I had some legal troubles down there. And I remember I walked into the courtroom, and I told them, I know I have problems with drinking and doing drugs, and I want to stop. And you just need to let me go up to West Virginia to be with my mom. And I'll stop. And the judge said, you're not going anywhere. And so then it was just like, oh, my God. You know, he's like, no, you're not going anywhere for at least 90 days. You're staying down here. And he said, you're quartered to go to AA. And I was like, say what? What was that? And he said, you're quartered to go to AA. And I said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. And he said, well, tough. And I remember my first meeting, I walked up. I was so nervous. I took a taxi cab there because I didn't have a license. Took a taxi cab there, and I got out of the taxi cab, and I said, you be back here. It was 8 o'clock meeting. I said, you be back here at 8. Pick me up. We're going. She said, okay. And I hate not knowing what's going on. I hate not knowing what's going on. So I wanted to walk into an AA meeting, just sit in the back, you know, and be there for, you know, a year or so. And then somebody turn around and be like, hey, who are you? I'd be like, oh, Chad, I've been here for a while now. You know, I know what's going on. I didn't want to say I didn't know what's going on. I didn't want to ask questions. And they dropped me out at my first AA meeting, and there was a whole bunch of people out there smoking cigarettes on a bench outside of a church. And I said, well, this is an AA meeting. I've seen movies before. You know, this has got to be the meeting. And I went into the room. And I tried to get a seat in the back, but right when I walked in the door, one of my buddy's dads was standing on the other door. And I knew he was sober. I knew he was in the program. And I didn't know he was going to be at that meeting, and he didn't know I was going to be at that meeting. And he grabbed me right when I came to the door. He said, "Chad, yeah." He said, "How you doing?" I was, I'm doing all right. And he was like, "You want a cup of coffee?" He says, "Good to see you." And, you know, that was, I don't know. I mean, you know, I've heard those words before in my life, but I've never heard them like that before. And I said, "Yeah, I'll take a cup of coffee." Even though I don't drink coffee, everybody else is drinking coffee. So, you know, story of my life, I guess I'll drink coffee. And so he took me to the side, and after the meeting, I was like, "I got to get out of here. I got a cab waiting for me. I got to get out of here." And he's like, "Let the cab wait." And he said, and he came up to me, and he said, "I want you, you don't take a cab to another meeting." He said, "Here's two numbers. I want you to call me or this other guy, and we'll take you to a meeting." And I was like, "No." Because it wasn't, once again, it wasn't like I wanted to be, you know, self-sufficient. I just didn't want to sit in a car and have an awkward conversation with somebody I didn't know. And that's it. And that's the thing, you know. And I didn't want to be uncomfortable. My whole time drinking, I didn't want to be uncomfortable. I wanted to be comfortable. And my comfortable is me drinking. You know, of course, I'm miserable and all the stuff that goes along, but that was my comfort. And these people are trying to pull me out of my comfort zone, trying to make me meet people and trying to make me talk to new people and everything like that. And I didn't want to do it. But he said, "Do you want to stay sober?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, shut up. You don't know anything." he said, "We already know how to get drunk. You don't know how to stay sober. So you have nothing we want." And I said, "All right." So I called him the next time I was going to a meeting. I called him. And he picked me up, and you know what? It wasn't an awkward conversation, because he already knew me, and I already knew him, you know, and we had a good talk on the way to the meeting. So I got to the meeting, and I sat down in the chair, and they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Now I'm getting ready for the meeting." They said, "Uh-uh." He said, "Go make coffee." I said, "I don't drink coffee, so therefore I don't know how to make coffee, so therefore I don't want to make your coffee." And he said, "Well, tough." He said, "Go make coffee." And he said, "I'll show you how to do it." And I was scared that people were going to not like the coffee and throw a fit, and then who made the coffee, and then there's that guy over there, and everybody would be pissed off at me. And you know what? I made coffee. I don't know if the coffee was good or not. I'm sure it was terrible, but nobody said anything. Nobody said anything, thank God, at that meeting. And, you know, and so I was, you know, after a while, I was making coffee for a little while, and I was getting comfortable in it, and you know, I was like, okay, it's not that bad. And then I walked up to a meeting one day to make coffee, and they said, "No." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" They said, "Go greet people at the door." I was like, "Oh, dear Lord, no." No. And they said, "Yes." And I said, "No, please." I said, I can't do it, man. I can't do it. And he said, "Only thing you do, put your hand out there, introduce yourself, and say, 'Welcome to the meeting.' That's it." I was like, "God, that sounds terrible." And they said, "Well, tough, do you want to stay sober? And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Go by the door then." So I sat there by the door. And you know what? It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And you know what? It was so pinnacle to my early sobriety to do things like that, because it made me feel part of something for the first time in my life. It was always, before I came into these rooms, it was always about me, 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 me. And when I got here, it was about us. And they didn't tell me that. They showed me that. And it was about the group. And I became part of a group. For the first time in a long time, I became part of a group. I'd been sober for 90 days, and I remember I got that red chip. Man, that was the most amazing chip I've ever got in my life. That was like, you know, that I remember that was just blew me away. I'd been sober for 90 days. Never thought I'd be able to do that. And so I thought, well, since now being sober, you know, for such a long time, and I know what's going on, I'm going to move out to Phoenix, Arizona. I didn't know anybody out in Phoenix, Arizona. But there was a school I wanted to go to, and there was a school that I was scared to go to when I was drinking, because it was my dream. And I knew when I was drinking that if I went after one of my dreams, then I would fail, and I would no longer have that dream. But if I didn't go for it, then I could always dream about that dream, because it would never be taken away. And then so I'd been sober for a while, and so 90 days, and I said, okay, I'm going to go out there against, you know, what people told me. They said, well, maybe you want to, you know, wait. And I said, well, I'm not going to do it. So I moved out to Phoenix, 2,000 miles away from anybody I knew. And I remember I was sitting out there the first night, and the thought came across my mind. I was like, well, you know, I could drink right now, and nobody would know. And luckily, one thing I did have in that house was a phone book and a phone. And I got on, I called the AA hotline, and they told me there was a meeting hall 3 blocks away from my apartment. Yeah. So, after that experience, it scared me. It scared me so bad. And so I said, okay, you know, I'm really, really going to jump into this. And, you know, I'm going to, because my sponsor, my first sponsor in Wilmington, he explained to me what a sponsor was. Well, they came up to me after my first meeting. Once again, me not wanting to say that I don't know what's going on. I heard sponsorship, sponsorship, sponsorship. And they said, do you have a sponsor? And throughout the whole meeting, I didn't want to ask what a sponsor was. So I thought, you know, sponsorship from, like, sporting events and stuff like that. I thought, I drew up the conclusion that a sponsor was somebody to pay me money while I got sober so I didn't have to work because I needed the me time. And so my first sponsor, I didn't know he was going to be my first sponsor at the time. He walked up to me after the meeting. He said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, I don't need a sponsor. I work. Thank you. And he said, no, you don't understand. And, you know, and I didn't understand. And he said, he sat me down, explained to me what a sponsor was. And he said, okay. And I said, okay, I don't think I want one of those. And he was like, well, tough, I'm going to be your sponsor. And he said, here's my phone number. Here's a book. I want you to read a chapter out of that book each week. And then I want you to call, and we're going to meet here, and we're going to talk about it. And, you know, and I did. I didn't call him as much as he wanted me to. But I did. I read the chapter out of that book, and we talked about it each week. And I found myself in that book. I found my feelings that just seemed like pure insanity to me that nobody else had. I found that it was in that book. And my thoughts that I thought nobody else had were in that book. And, you know, and what happened to me when I was drinking that didn't happen to anybody else, it was in that book. And, you know, and that was only the first couple chapters, you know. And so I moved out to Phoenix, and I said, well, I'm going to take this thing seriously now, and I'm going to get a sponsor, and I'm going to, you know, we're going to get into the book, and we're going to take the steps, and because I want a piece of this stuff that everybody has. So I've been out in Phoenix for 3 months, and, you know, things were going great in the program, so I thought, well, now I'm 9 months sober, you know, or 6 months sober at the time, so I said, well, now what I need, I need a wife. You know, I mean, I want that white picket fence. I mean, you know, my life, I'm going to school now. I've got things in line. I got everything ready. You know, I think I was 21 at the time. And I said, well, you know, life's going so well. You know, I want that white picket fence. So I met a girl out there. And, you know, we got together and we moved in together after 2 months. And we got engaged after 4 months. And I was like, cool. Awesome. This is what I want. This is what I want. And this is what my life is going to be. And, you know, and things went well between me and her for a while. And then, you know, of course, it turned sour. We were both early sobriety. And, we didn't know anything. And things turned sour. But she got pregnant. And, you know, I remember she told me she was pregnant. And we were already engaged. And she told me she was pregnant. And I thought, awesome. You know, I didn't say anything, I think, for a day or something like that. Because I was stunned or... You know, I don't know why I was stunned, but I was stunned, and then after that, I was like, cool, this is exactly, everything's falling into plan, you know, and then people in the program call, tell me, you know, my sponsor especially, might want to pump the brakes a little bit here, you know, and no, we're good to go, and like I said, things started falling out between me and her, and I didn't understand it. This is what I want. This is what I want. You know, God, why aren't you giving me what I want? It's not. I'm not asking. I'm sober now, and we ended up we split up, and you know, once again, there I was living with my sponsor. My sponsor took me in at the time, which, you know, I don't know if it was the right move on his part, but he took me in, and I needed it, and, you know, and I was sitting there, and now I had a baby on the way, and I was just like, oh my God, how did this happen? You know, this is not what's supposed to happen when you get sober. These situations only happen to drunk people. They're not supposed to happen when you get sober. And, you know, and that's when I learned the whole life lesson is, you know, because we don't, you know, we don't listen, or I don't listen all that well. And I've got a, you know, people told me not to drive drunk, so I get a DUI. And I was like, I'll show you. And I'll get a DUI. And, you know, and that's the thing. People are just like, well, you know, you don't try to take in your life in your own hands. Don't, you know. And I, well, I'll show you. And, you know, I'll run things into the ground. I'll set this whole place on fire. I'll show you, you know. And then I remember sitting there and just pulling out my hair because I was just so, I just didn't know what to do. I didn't understand how it got to this point. And, you know, and I went out to the desert and I was like, God, me and you. Desert, you know, we're going. So I went out in the desert, and I had this big fight with God, yelling, and nobody's out there, so you can look as sane as you want to out there. So I remember yelling and screaming, kicking off my boots, throwing a huge fit. Why? Why does it have to be like this? Why? And I said, finally, I said, God, you know what? I tried to give you my life, you know, to turn my life over in your hands, and it doesn't work. I said, so why don't you just go ahead and take it? Just take it. I don't want it anymore. Just take it. And, you know, and I do believe that's what happened that night. So I came back with a new willingness. I came back with a new willingness to listen to folks in the program. And, you know, and I came back and, you know, I was more at peace. And this one old timer told me, he said, you can get angry at God. Get angry at him. So it doesn't matter. He's not human. He doesn't have an ego. He said, go ahead, yell at him, do whatever you want. And so that's what I did that night. And, you know, I came back with a new piece and you know, a new, I don't want to say understanding, but kind of just a new feeling. And so I then had to, find out, you know, try to handle this mess I'd got myself into because I had a child on the way. And so, the mom, my daughter's mom had, relapsed while pregnant and stuff like that. And I was in I was in school, and I'd already been accepted to go to a school out in Chicago by that time. And I talked to a whole bunch of people in the program, prayed a whole bunch about it. And these times were just like, you know, I look back on them, and they were hard times, but they were some of the best times of my life because I've never been so close to God in my life. And to this program, you know, it's just that feeling of that God was right there the whole time. And, I mean, it was miserable, but throughout the talking to people in this program and praying, we decided on the best decision would be adoption. And once again, I was like, it doesn't happen when you're sober. This doesn't happen. People don't give kids up for adoption while they're in sobriety. But I did. And it was, we got to pick the parents out. And we, it's open adoption. And I remember the night that my daughter was born, I was there. And I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go to the birth because I didn't want to see her. I was scared to death of her. I was scared to death, and because I knew what was going on. And I remember I went to an AA meeting before I went up to the hospital because it was an induced labor. I went up to the hospital or the AA meeting, and I remember I was chairing the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, I said, I need help right now. I can't do this. I need help. And I think like 8 people came up, and they cried with me. And some of these people I don't even know. They didn't know my situation, but they cried with me. And they helped me. And then I went up to the hospital. You know, through the strength of others, I went up to that hospital. She took forever to be born, too. And so I sat there in the waiting room and, you know, got phone calls the whole night. And finally she was born and I got to hold her. And I went to work the next day. And then I got to hold her again the next day. And I got to hand her over to her parents. And it was it was hard, but it wasn't as hard as it could have been. She got handed to a family, a wonderful family that takes great care of her. And I got, you know, I got through it with my family. And it was the best situation for her. And, you know, it still hurts to this day. I mean, there's still nights that I do lie awake. She's 6 years old now, and I get pictures from her pictures from her parents all the time. And, you know, and it still is hard. It still is very hard. But I could only imagine how hard it would be without this program. Because I didn't have to drink. I went to a meeting, and I went to a meeting after that. And I got through, and I didn't have to drink, and I got through it sober. And I remember this old timer came up to me because he said, you know, I just told him, I said, I don't know if I can do this. I just don't know if I can go through with it. And it was funny. This old timer became good friends with him, and he was a crusty old man, and he was hilarious. He worked at a salon, and it was funny. It was just this crusty old drunk that worked at a salon, rented a chair at a salon, and I'd go there and get my hair cut by him, and we'd sit there for 3-4 hours and just talk and sit out on the back porch and smoke cigarettes and, you know, and just talk. And he told me, he said, I just don't know if I can do this sober, man. I just don't know. And I was 2 years sober, and he said, you're still mourning the death of your friend. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, you're still mourning the death of alcohol in your life. And he said, there came a point in my sobriety, and he said, I'm sure there's going to have to come a point in your sobriety that if you got to make the decision whether you want to live your life sober or you want to go back to drinking. And he said, once you come across that point, you cross that imaginary line, he said, you'll be ready to kick the dirt on alcohol's grave and go about your life like you're sober and live your life like you're sober. And so, and that's, I believe, you know, that imaginary line was crossed on that day. And I said, you know what, Gordy, I want to be sober. I don't want to drink anymore. And up until that point, I don't think I could have said I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to drink, but I did want to drink. You know, that not want was just a little bit higher than that want. And that's all it takes at first. It's all it takes. So you got to have that not want just a little bit higher than that want. And I remember I called my sponsor and I told him, I said, man, I called him up one night and I said, I want to drink. I want to drink. And it was nice running through the program with you. And it was, thank you for doing all your work. And I'm going to go out and drink. And he said, no, you're not. No, didn't you just hear me? And I said, I want to drink. And he said, that's okay. You're an alcoholic. Of course you're going to want to drink. He said, don't feel bad about it. He said, but don't. And I said, well, I just went to a meeting and, you know, and he said, and I said, I just don't feel any different. He said, well, why don't you just go lay your head down on the pillow and go to sleep and don't drink. Thank God for another sober day. You know what? Sounds stupid. But like, you know, I was like, what? You know? And you know what? But I did that. I did that. And I got through that day sober. You know? And it's simple things like that. You know? And just talking to your sponsor, you know, talking to another person in these rooms and, you know, getting through it together. Not alone, but together. That's how we do it. And, you know, and the service work that I thought was BS, it wasn't. I know that now. And so after the adoption, I moved on to Chicago, and I lived in Chicago for about 5 months. And because I made it through that school that I thought I would never accomplish. I never would make it through. I made it through. Thanks to this program. And, you know, and I made it through that school and I moved out. I got accepted to like a graduate school or whatever out in Chicago because I was actually, I made good grades. And, you know, and actually somebody wanted me to go to their school to factory train me out in Chicago. So I said, okay, I'll go. And, you know, this time I wasn't really nervous about moving because I knew I had family already out in Chicago. I hadn't met them, but I knew I had family out there. And I moved out to Chicago, drove across country. After all that, it was like my daughter had been born like 2 or 3 weeks before that. And I moved out there. And I remember I got to my apartment and there was no phone book. And I was like, I don't know how to do this now. And, you know, I went out and I said, well, you know what? I see those stickers on people's back of people's cars. So I'm going to go find one of those. And you know what? That is a crapshoot in Chicago. I mean, Chicago's a big place. And God knows, I got three blocks away from my house and I saw one of those stickers. And so this guy, I followed him. And this is insane, but, you know, I followed him and he pulled into a parking lot. And I got out of the car and I was like, "Hey, man." And he's like, "What?" And I was like, "Are you a friend of Bill W's?" And he said, "Yeah, why?" And I said, "Because I need a meeting and I don't know where to go." And he said, "Come on, we can find you a meeting." And he wrote me the address. And he said, "Actually, this meeting hall is having steak dinner tonight. And, you know, the speaker meeting and everything like that." And I was like, "Cool." And one of my friends out in Phoenix had told me, whenever you go to a new meeting or a new place, when you move out to a new place, you go to a meeting and you say, "You know, my name is Chad. I'm an alcoholic. I need friends. I'm new to the area." And that's what I said out there. I got up, introduced myself. And any other place, it would just be kind of like, "All right, cool. Well, that's, you know, nice for you." And I said, "You know, my name's Chad. I'm an alcoholic. I just moved here from Phoenix, and I need friends." And that night, I was hanging out with people after the meeting. We got an ice cream. There's no other program you can do that with. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, if I were to move without this program, you know, it would take me like 7 months to go out with somebody and eat or whatever. That night, first night I get in town, I'm out with seven friends eating, you know, and eating ice cream and steak dinner. And, you know, I believe, you know, God's placed me in the right points and through my life. And everything that I've gone through in this program is things that I need to go through. And I didn't understand it at the time. But as you get through these things, and you do get through these things, you know, through the birth of my daughter and the adoption, I thought the world was going to stop spinning that day. I thought life was over. No, it wouldn't go on any further. But you know what? The world keeps spinning. No matter what, the world keeps on going. And it's our job, or, you know, it's my job when I'm sober to keep on going with it. And to, you know, I can't stop there. I got to keep on going, and I've got to stay sober, and I've got to keep on showing up. And so I made it through the school out in Chicago, and then they offered me a job out here in Richmond. I was like, "Well, you know, I've never seen a picture of Richmond, but I'd never seen a picture of Phoenix." And so I was like, "Well, you know, I'll move out there and see what happens." And I moved out to Phoenix, moved out to Richmond about 6 years ago. And once again, I was placed in a great place. Had friends right away, had a home group right away, had a sponsor right away. And, you know, and it just, they did the same thing. "My name's Chad. I'm an alcoholic. I'm new here. I need friends." And that's the thing is, when I was drinking, I could never imagine doing anything like that. Because I was scared to death of everybody. But today, through this program, I can do that. And once again, I got thrown into service work. Boo. But it was great. You know, at first, I was just like, "Ah!" You know, I think I was, what? Well, I don't know, 3 or 4 years sober when I moved out to Richmond. And I was like, "Well, you know, I don't need service work anymore. I'm past that point. I'm sober, baby. I'm here." You know? And no, I did. And you know, in Richmond, I've been able to, you know, go to jails. I've never been to a jail. And I've been able to go to a couple jails since I've been in Richmond. And that's fantastic. That's an amazing experience. It's scary as crap, but, you know, it's an amazing experience. And, you know, and I've been able to truly be the person God wanted me to be the whole time. Just a good person. I don't have to put up the badass exterior anymore that I thought I did. I don't have to run. I don't have to fight. I can just be me. And it's a nice feeling. And, I can be a son again, and, you know, and I can be a brother again. I have five brothers, and, you know, and I can be a father, the best one I can right now. And by doing that, you know, it's, and once again, I hit a real hard spot with that again a couple months ago. And, you know, through this program and through, you know, I had to seek a little outside help with that. I got through it, and I got good suggestions. And I'm able to go on. And, you know, and today I truly can say that, you know, I'm able to love. throughout my whole life, I hated to think, you know, people love, you know, like, I always didn't want love for some reason. I wanted, oh, life's so hard on me, you know, life's so hard on me. And I could, you know, I could never say that, because I did have loving parents, and I did have loving brothers, and, you know, I did have people in my life that loved me, but I could never, ever exchange that love. I just didn't know how to do it. And, you know, and today I can. I can be part of a loving relationship. I can exchange that love with my mom and with my brothers, and, you know, and it's all thanks to these rooms. You know, that it didn't give me my life back. It gave me a life, and I truly believe that, because what I was doing before wasn't anything. And today, you know, I'm able to say that I work the job I've always wanted to work. You know, and it's thanks to this program. I'm part of my family. I'm sober. I'm closing on a house next week, which is insane to me to even think of that. And, you know, it's just all because of this program, and it's all because of you guys, and it's all because of just showing up. Because throughout my whole story, I've been pretty daggone unwilling at points, but I showed up. I was willing to show up, and I wanted to be sober. And that's all it takes at first. Just show up and want to be sober. We'll take care of the rest at first. And they did for me. And I'm indebted to this program. I owe my life to this program. And thank y'all for having me up here.